Cheryl, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I surprised Cheryl last night at a party, and I said, would you be interested in being interviewed, being on my podcast? And she maybe reluctantly said, okay. So we're going to be talking with Cheryl about, well, we'll find out in the next hour. So first of all, Cheryl, maybe we should tell our listeners our connection on how we met. And that would be through your dear friend and my brother-in-law, Terry Lacona. How did you meet Terry?
Well, in 1973, when I graduated, I started working for the public broadcasting station here in Austin. At the time, it was KLRU, and I was doing television. I had heard about a guy that had just joined, and he was doing radio, and he was from somewhere called Poughkeepsie, New York. I had never heard of Poughkeepsie, New York, knew nothing about Poughkeepsie, New York. And one day, for some reason or the other, both of us were assigned to a story for a newscast. And I met him, and he walks in, and I'm going, whoa, dude with big afro, you know, from somewhere called Poughkeepsie. This ought to be interesting. And then the next day, we were in a production meeting, and they told me that Terry was going to join the television part of the station. And I went, okay. And all during the production meeting, when they were talking about, you know, lighting and assigning staff and stuff, and Terry would make these cracks and nobody would laugh. And I thought they were just hilarious, you know, and I was trying my best not to laugh, you know, but I did. And so when it was over with, I walked up to him and I said, can we have lunch? And he goes, yeah. And so after that, we just became good friends, and it's been 43, 45 years later, and here we are. And the weird thing about it was when I found out he had a sister named Cheryl, and I said, okay. Then the sister named Cheryl married a guy named Charles, and I was Cheryl, and I married a guy named Charles. And then I found out that his dad's birthday and my dad's birthday were the same. His mom's birthday and the twins in our families were the same. And my daughter's birthday is the same day as his brother's. So the way I figure it is somewhere along the line in this big cosmic place, we had met before and we were just meeting each other again because it's been very relaxed. It's been fun. The families have gotten along together, grown close together. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I met Terry from Poughkeepsie. And now I know where Poughkeepsie is and know what Poughkeepsie is about. And I know Hudson Valley.
And were you at the station before Terry was?
I was only there for maybe 3 weeks before. That was at, I don't know how to describe it. It was during the Cultural Revolution when they were trying to get more Black programming on television. I happened to have graduated with a degree in journalism, and I saw it and I went, why not? Go on over there and do the interview. And I did the interview and they hired me. I really didn't know what a producer was then, but I learned very quickly what a producer was. But I had only been there maybe 2 to 3 weeks before Terry showed up with all of his Afro regalia.
Well, would you know or could you tell the difference between television and radio production? Of course, here in Austin, the whole city has grown huge. But from, say, the 70s till now, it sounds like it was an easier time then?
Radio and television production definitely was easier. And I would almost think that KLRU was working off of what later on I called a zero-based budget. Things were much simpler then. On radio, there were probably about 4 personalities at the station. But what I liked about the station is it wasn't programmed, that each of those people that had a radio show could play what they wanted to play, talk about what they wanted to talk about. And so it wasn't so even though PBS is non-commercial, it wasn't as commercial driven as it is now, because now it seems like things are programmed. You're supposed to play this, 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 and this, and you don't get to bring in your own personality into it. And it's the same with television. We were connected to the University of Texas, so most of the staff were people that were majoring in communication, staff as far as camera people, sound, lighting. There were probably, yes, there were people that were hired on staff to do that, but the people that work with them were mostly interns from the University of Texas and other universities around. So it was very simple. It was very straightforward. You got in there, you shot it, you did it live. You had three cameras to work with and wow. prayed that the lighting would hold out. And yes, it was much simpler then, but it was much purer. It was much more fun and it was more natural. And you, that personality or that producer, controlled more of what went into the program than you had to worry about what your sponsors were going to say or what the board thought. They gave you had more freedom, and I enjoyed that freedom.
Do you think age had anything to do with it?
I hope not. I was 23 years old, you know, and didn't know hardly anything, you know, at all. I thought I did. I thought I was very grown. And now that I am 68, I realize at 23, I really didn't know anything. And I was just kind of like, I was learning as I did. And that was the wonderful thing about PBS and NPR, was that you could do that. You know, they allowed you to do that. It was so new, and it was such a revolutionary idea, the whole idea of public television and public radio, that you were allowed to do that. And they hired young people because, you know, they can hardly pay any money. And so if you're just graduating from college, you'll be happy to have any salary. And so they weren't paying us the mega bucks that they pay people, you know, now. And so, yes, we were young. We were young.
And you were telling me that you, you also love to take photographs.
Yes.
And what was your dream job as a photographer?
Now, when I was a little kid, I wanted to be a photographer for National Geographic, Ebony Magazine, or Look Magazine. That was my biggest dream. That's all I could think about. And then when I applied for college, I was living in Anchorage. My father was stationed there, graduated from high school there, and didn't know a whole lot about colleges in Texas. And I knew that my parents were eventually coming back to Texas, and they desired us to go to college in Texas. So we only applied for Texas schools. We got accepted at a lot. We put them in a hat, shook it up, drew out a name, and I got Southwest Texas State University in San Marcos. And so that's where we ended up going. Well, they didn't have a photography major. And so then I knew then I was going to fall back on journalism anyway. So I ended up majoring in journalism with a specialty in marketing and public relations. And I did photography for the university paper, for the yearbook, for clubs, that type of thing. So I just kind of did the photography on the side. And during my career in different places that I've worked, I've always done the photography for the brochures, pamphlets, newsletters, that type of thing. So I've kind of gotten a chance to do the photography, but gosh, it would have been so wonderful to work for National Geographic. But again, that time period, we have to remember that was right after civil rights. That was when the thoughts about affirmative action began. So a black photographer at National Geographic wasn't exactly National Geographic's dream. It was mine, though. And Ebony, there was a wonderful photographer there that I wanted to work with. he wasn't giving up his job, you know. No. So I knew, and he was probably in his 40s, so he was, you know, hitting that peak. So I knew he was going to be there a while, so I gave up on the Ebony thing. So like I said, when the opportunity came along to get into something new that was called public television, I took it, and I'm so glad they took me.
How long were you with KLRU?
I stayed there for 7 years, and I decided to leave when, this is probably terrible to say, when I found most of the young graduates that were graduating from the University of Texas that were a little blonder than me, a little taller than me, were more fighting for my job, you know, and yes, I loved it. I loved it very much, but it wasn't worth, you know, all of that. And at that time, too, I became interested in politics. And there was a man that was running as an independent for a senator, a Senate seat from Texas. And his staff was so mixed culturally, racially, economically, that I decided, hey, let me go over here and check this out, see what Texas politics are like, and see what national politics are like. And so I took a leave of absence from the station to do this. And then when I got, after the campaign was over and I went back to the station, I found that my heart wasn't there anymore. I didn't think, I thought the impact that I would make doing public relations and getting in different ventures, and particularly in politics, would be more than what I was doing with the half-hour TV show that I had that was geared towards Black culture. I didn't get in enough guests in Austin or had enough people that came to Austin that were national that would sit down and talk to a tiny public television station. So you weren't getting those kind of interviews. And to me, there were only so many local things that you could do. Mm-hmm. And so that was where, that was kind of like when I decided, let me see if there's something different that you can do that would have a bigger impact on the people of my culture. So that's when I decided to leave.
What happened to that candidate?
The candidate lost by 250 votes.
Oh, my goodness.
And that just about broke my heart. But the best thing about that whole campaign is that I work with the manager for East Texas. East Texas is where Stephen F. Austin, when he bought people to Texas, they settled at Washington on the Brazos, which is in Washington County in Texas. And that whole East Texas was also where a lot of white slave owners, when they thought the Civil War was going to happen, started shipping their slaves to Texas. And Stephen F. made an agreement with Mexico that they could come in, but any Black child or any slave child born in Texas at the age of 12, they would be free. And so my history of my family and the people that I knew in between, I'm a military kid, so in between stations, we would come to Washington County, go to school for 3 or 4 months, be in a totally Black environment, because then it was very segregated. They did not integrate till 1967. And so when I was a little kid, you'd come back to a totally Black environment, and you knew that there were Anglo people in the town, but your neighborhood was so, you know, separate from them. And so there was such history in that area that I knew nothing about. And being able to go to small towns and doing those political speeches and organizing and door-to-door and meeting with the Black leaders of that town, I, of course, met with the black leaders and the other manager that was in charge of East Texas. He was Anglo. And then we would mix people together, which was very hard to do because they didn't, the people in those small towns, both black and white, did not want to be mixed together in their politics or to talk about politics. So it was a really weird kind of a situation, but I learned so much. Sitting on a porch, talking with an old lady that's 80 years old and sipping lemonade, I learned more about the history of East Texas and black and white folks in East Texas than I think I ever could have learned from a book. And so that experience, and then going back to a television station, you know, where you represent equally both sides and, you know, you talk about what's happening, it just wasn't like what it was out in the real world, in those rural areas, in the country, in East Texas, that carried so much of my family's history and other black people in Texas history. So I think that's what made me leave. The politics was very exciting, and PBS was nice, safe, sturdy, sure, pure, just absolutely marvelous, but it wasn't as exciting as getting out there in the neighborhood and talking to people and having experiences with people and understanding why those races in those small towns did not mix together socially or politically. The whole get out the vote effort. I went to one county. Y'all aren't from Texas. You won't know. It's called Panola County. But anyway, when I was in Panola County and I was getting up doing an introductory speech, talking about who I was and about the candidate, and this man yelled from the audience, "We don't need you here because we don't want our niggers registered." And I'm sitting up here and I'm thinking, okay, did he just say what I thought he said? Now, I hadn't heard that. Now, I read it in books, you know, but I had never heard that spoken out loud anywhere, and particularly in a political meeting. And all I could do was sit there and I said, okay, let me explain one thing to you the way this goes. If you do not register and make sure that black folks are registered in this county and they get to the polls to vote, the person that you want to win is not going to win. It is just that simple. I said, so you handle it the way you want to handle it, but these are the facts. If you don't do this, it ain't going to happen, you know? And so I called back to the office and I said, you guys, guess what just happened? You know? And they were all apologetic and stuff. And I'm like, hey, this is what people are. People are what they are. All I can do is try and change that man's mind and show him how it is to his advantage that this happens. And sometimes we need to do things to our advantage and not worry about what our personal feelings are. If it's for the greater good and electing that man was for the greater good, then you need to put your personal feelings aside and go for the greater good. And he was a greater good for black and whites and Hispanics in Texas. So, but that was much more exciting than public television. So I think that's why I left. And it was a really hard decision because I love public television. I love NPR. Real fans still contribute, you know, to both and support them wholeheartedly. But I needed to move on. I needed to do something different.
Did you continue a journalistic career? Because that sounds like that was a perfect example of, or a potential for writing something down or doing some kind of recording of history.
You would think so, wouldn't you? Now, my problem with journalism is that you have to ask people tough questions, and sometimes it ain't none of your business, you know? And I was not very good at asking people about business that was none of my business. So that's when I knew that I probably needed to concentrate on something like public relations, marketing, doing community relations, that type of thing more than being a reporter. I was not nosy enough to be a reporter. And if you're a reporter, you have to be curious and you have to ask tough questions. And that was not what, that was just not me. Yeah. And so that's when I switched from being what I considered a journalist to going into public relations and marketing.
How would you describe public relations and marketing, since it was a part of your life for such a long time?
Okay, public relations and marketing can be used for good or it could be used for evil. Now, I decided I was going to use it for good. So I did not try and the products that I decided to market and the public relations that I decided to do, I decided to go for the greater good. I was not convincing people that you need this new gadget because the people that I was working for, they were marketing this gadget. I decided that I was going to do more public service type like things. And I guess that's because I'm a kid of the Kennedy era and because my dad was in the service and he believed in public service. And after working at the TV station and knowing that it was public service, it just kind of got to me. So when I picked public relations and marketing, I picked subjects like, I was the marketing director for a historically black university, Houston Tillotson University, here in Austin, Texas. When I left there, I switched over to energy and water conservation. When I started public relations for them, my boss told me that what I was supposed to do was change people's mindset to conserving the environment, water, and energy, and that I should work myself out of a job by the year 2020. And so that's what my efforts were geared towards, creating programs in weatherization and water conservation and green energy. Most of the programs that are with the city of Austin right now that deal with water and energy conservation, there were 14 of us, and I was on the beginning of creating those. And after we got the programs in place, marketing them. And I loved every single minute of it. My friends called me hippie crazy. I was one of them crazy hippies from over there at UT. And the city council used to call our office UT South, which indicated we were the hippies that were working on all these, you know, bizarre energy programs that no one had ever heard of, you know, before. But it was, and we also did geothermal research and electric cars. We had some of the first electric cars for the city.
When are we talking?
This was early 80s. So I'd say from about 80 to 82, we were putting the programs together. And then after that, we started implementation of the programs and finding funding for them. You know, so that was exciting. Back then, energy and water conservation were a new thing. And now, everybody does it. Everybody recycles. Everybody, you know, conserves water. They've got aerators in their bathroom and, you know, watering systems that cut on and cut off when they're supposed to. When you're doing your lights, even when you're buying light bulbs, you're looking for conservative ones. So I think I did my job, you know. So I was very, very pleased when I finally, you know, ended up retiring. But the photography part of it was a lot of fun. Most of the brochures and stuff I shot, you know, the photos for. Getting out into the neighborhoods, all different kinds of neighborhoods, from the very rich neighborhoods that had multi-million dollar housing down to the ones that used to be in East Austin before it became gentrified, where a house might be worth $30,000. But they still had conservation needs, and we were able to make sure like I said, this is using it for good rather than evil, making sure that everyone had equal access to the programs. Mm-hmm. If you were rich or you were poor, you had access to the programs. And that to me was my bigger thing, was making sure that everyone had an equal opportunity to participate. So that's that was the legacy I left, and I'm very pleased with it.
So you were probably involved in the outreach to get to the community.
Yes, I did. I did so many community meetings that when I would be in grocery stores or the post office, people would come up and talk to me and go, "Oh, I heard you speak last night and it was just so wonderful." But yes, like I said, I went from neighborhood to neighborhood. Austin has what they call neighborhood associations. And just about every neighborhood, no matter how rich you are or how poor you are, has a neighborhood association. So I worked most of my community outreach through neighborhood associations and then through the schools. I would do meetings with the PTA. I would leave flyers at the schools for kids. We put little packages together for the kids. We created a program, lessons in energy and water conservation that you could use in art, you could use in math, you could use in an English class. And then we paid the teachers. We trained the teachers. We paid them to come to the training. We provided all of the books for them, all of the slides that they needed. Back then, you know, we weren't using computers, but all of the slides and stuff that they needed, everything that they needed to teach about energy and water conservation. And we started at the third grade level. And so the teachers would do this. We would have packages for the kids that had shower heads in them, faucet aerators, dyes, so then they could, you know, drop a colored tablet in the toilet and see how much water drained out. They could measure and use it for the math, or they could talk about their experience of putting the shower head in with their dad or mom and how funny it was and the mistakes that they made. And they wrote that for an English project. So there was just, it was interdisciplinary. And by the time I left, the children that I started with in third grade, they were 18 years old, and it was their first year of voting, but they knew about water issues. Mm. We talked about water issues. I stressed to them that by this time that we are currently in, that water was going to become a major factor, and there would be wars fought over water. There would be people and countries and cities and town that would fight about how much water you could draw out of above ground resources and underground resources, and protecting aquifers. All of those kinds of things were in this this education package that we put together. And like I said, I'm very happy to know that my children that I started out with the program first started, by the time I left, they were 18, they were ready to vote, and they were educated on water issues. And also by the time I left, we had reached over 10,000 students. And so to me, I felt very good about that. And I loved going to the schools, talking to the kids, going to neighborhoods, talking to the neighbors. And the one thing that I learned is there's not much difference between rich folks and poor folks. All of them want just about the same thing: safe drinking water, good air to breathe, you know, and being able to have a future of our environment that's good to pass on to their kids. And so it was fun. It was great. And I think I did a good job. I like to think I did a good job.
I think from example you have. And I think, you know, having myself come to Austin in the mid-80s, starting in the mid-80s, you certainly have seen the change of the city of Austin to its present. And when you're doing these lessons for water conservation, I mean, you're talking primarily to an urban crowd. Do you think that has reached out to the rural areas?
Again, when I said equal access, I also went to schools in the country. They weren't necessarily within Austin's electric or, you know, within their range, but they were just on the edge, but they were still rural areas. Well, we got to those schools too, because we knew those kids were not necessarily going to stay there. They were going to end up moving into Austin or moving into new cities. They needed to know about conservation just as much as kids within the cities did. So we reached out to those rural areas that were right outside Austin city limits. They were not incorporated, and again, they were very rural, but we offered them exactly the same thing.
Well, you're also talking local politics and local culture. Do you think the overall federal government is doing the proper job then and now, and should they stay maybe more out of it? Should they be more involved?
That's an interesting question. Back when we started doing it, the federal government was very much involved. One of the first awards that I got was from, who was president then? It was Clinton, I think, was president. And that was one of the first awards that our department got for their efforts towards, you know, environmental and energy conservation. They gave monies for programs for people to retrofit. It was very much supported by the federal government, very much supported by the state government. And that changed drastically. That changed drastically. Basically, when the Republicans took over after, you know, Clinton, because their concentration wasn't really on energy and environmental conservation. And so the funds that had been available before were cut almost to nothing. And so then it became a very local kind of issue. The state funds too were cut, and so it became a local issue. Now, Austin was always kind of a progressive type like of a city, and by the time those cuts were made, we had really pushed very hard and got people to adapt the thoughts of environmental, energy, and water conservation. And so they were on board for keeping the programs and expanding the programs. And the electric department, which funded most of them from their general funds, was along with it too. They were doing a lot of research in solar. They were doing a lot of research in geothermal. They wanted to make solar cheaper. And so because the city of Austin was willing to put that kind of money in, that's how the program stayed here, and they're still funded here, and they still exist here. But the federal government, yes, I do think that they have a responsibility. Water is limited. We have a very limited amount of water, even here in the United States. And after we saw what happened with Flint, and we're seeing what happened in other places, they need to seriously take an active role. You expect, when you turn on that tap, to have some clean water. You expect that. That's your right, to have clean water. And when you don't, there's got to be a problem somewhere. And if it is a problem, then it needs to be fixed. And you start local, state, and then national. And your national government, if these other folks aren't doing anything about it, they're supposed to be there to make you safe, to give you the things that you need, not that you want, but that you need, and you need water. And so, yes, they have a responsibility to do that. And I find it very disappointing that they're not concentrating on looking at the limited sources of water that we have in these United States and making sure that people are able to get the water that they need. And I'm not talking about for making your yard pretty. You know, I'm talking about the basic necessities that you need for water, and your water needs to be clean. And yes, they can do a better job. All of them can do a better job, and shame on them for not doing a better job. And I'm hoping these children that learned all of this stuff from us are bugging those people and saying, look, I learned in school, you know, water is limited and you need to be taking care of our resource. This is what I'm hoping is going to happen. But yes, I am.
And you also want to approaching the children is to, that gets filtered up.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. When we were little kids, buckle your seatbelt. You know, they taught it to the kids. And Lord, when we would get in the car, the first thing we'd say is, buckle your seatbelt, Mom. Is your seatbelt buckled? You know, well, it's the same thing with water. If you start at the third grade level through about fifth grade, kids are still open to listening to what adults say. By the time you get to junior high school, you think you know everything and you ain't going to listen to nothing that an adult has to say. So that's why we concentrated on that group. And yes, it trickles from the kids. Dad, did you turn out the light when you left the bathroom? You're leaving the water running while you're brushing your teeth, you know, because if I do that now and the water is running, I go, oh my goodness, I taught these kids and I turn it off immediately. So yes, that's the only one of the few things that I know. It doesn't exactly trickle down, it trickles up, you know, but it works. If you teach children, they will teach the parents. So yes, that was our idea, was teaching the children, which will then end up leading to the parents doing it, which then by the time the children are able to vote, they will vote for people that will do it.
Now, you mentioned that your father was in the military. Was it the Air Force?
Yes.
And when you were living in Alaska, how many months out of the year? Because I'm always curious, living in New York, and I've lived in California and New Jersey, but I always find it interesting to learn about a state. And Alaska is not one of those I know much about, unfortunately. Tell me about Alaska.
Alaska, I love with all of my heart. I had never seen anything so beautiful. We had been in different places, but Alaska. I lived in a place called Anoka Valley the first time we went to Anchorage. And it's in Anchorage, but it's a housing division in Anchorage. And it was at the base of the Chugiak mountain range. I could sit on my porch and I could watch the moose, you know, going up this mountain. And for rendezvous time in February, we could watch the native Alaskans coming from the top of that mountain, making that trail through the snow and coming down for the start of fur rendezvous. That's how close the mountains were. The joy of being able to walk through woods and eat cranberries and not worry about snakes and stuff. My sisters and I, we would go out to the woods that were right behind this housing place and base, and we would read books and we would put on plays and we would stay out there for hours. When we would go camping with our parents, we would get water directly from the stream and drink it. We would put, you know, our sodas and stuff, my parents, their beers, you know, in the water to cool them off so you didn't have to take coolers with you. But there was nothing like dipping your cup in that stream and drinking that ice cold water. And now that I'm older, I understand it was filtered from coming through the mountains. By the time it got through all of the rocks and stuff and got into the lakes and the streams, it was pretty pure. Now, I wouldn't say that now with all of the drilling that's being done in Alaska, you know, and the growth that's occurred there, but it was just the most beautiful place I'd ever seen. And the very first Christmas that I ever saw snow, that Christmas Eve, I was in fourth grade and we were looking out the window and it started snowing and you could see the mountain range and the skiers on it. And it was just like a postcard. And I just didn't think that that could possibly be real. The thing I didn't like about it was when I went to school in the morning, it was dark during the winter time. And when I came home, it was dark. The first time I saw the northern lights, I was, again, fourth grade out in the Anoka Valley, and I was walking to school, and I looked up, and I saw all of these lights in the sky, and it looked like they were dancing. Oh, I was scared to death. I went running home and I went, Mom, Mom, there's something out there. There's something out there. Look at the sky. Look at the sky. You know, and she goes out and she says, girl, that's the Northern Lights. You know? And I said, what are they? And so she explained to me what they were. And then when we got to school that morning, the teacher said, oh, children, did y'all see the Northern Lights this morning? I went to say, yeah, I saw them. And they scared the hell out of me. You know? And another time when I was in 12th grade, I lived on base, and I was the only high school kid, so I had to walk through this quad and across a playground to get to school, to get to the bus stop. And I was walking along, and it was a fresh snow, and I got caught in this drift up to my neck. There was nobody out there. All of the parents had already left for work. And it was me, and I couldn't think of anybody finding me, and I thought for sure I was going to freeze to death. And then David Rail, this guy that lived at the other end of the quad, he happened to be coming through, and I screamed, David, David, and he came over, and he dug me out. And so that was the most horrible experience that I had with snow. But in the summertime, Alaska is, again, beautiful. We went swimming in the lakes. It would be, my parents would go to a party at 9 o'clock at night, and it would be light. They would come home at 2 o'clock in the morning, and the sun would just be rising. And so we got into a lot of trouble when we first got there, because in Texas or in other places, we had to be home by the time the streetlights came on. Well, they didn't come on in Anchorage in the summertime that first year we were there. And we were out at the playground just cutting up, having a good time. My mother came down there and she said, do y'all know that it is 10 o'clock at night? Wow. And we're going, no, the sun isn't down. And she says, Lord, didn't y'all learn anything about this place when you came here? And so after that, we kept a watch on, and so we could know when it was time to go home. And they put foil on the windows so we could go to sleep at night, because the sun would be shining brightly, you know, through the windows when it was time for you to go to bed. But I have never seen a place as beautiful as Alaska, and going further in into Fairbanks and seeing the mountains, just, and the people. The people are so wonderful. The cool thing that I thought about Alaska was that more than they cared about your color, they cared if you knew how to survive a winter. You know, if you could make it through a winter, because several of my friends, you know, they had relatives that died that didn't make it back to their car for some reason or the other and ended up freezing to death. And so the cold was not something that you played with. No. And so those survival skills, knowing how to fish, you know, knowing how, if it gets cold, how to make a shelter that will protect you. And they took, that's what the kinds of things that we did in Girl Scout. They took us out to the woods and we learned those kinds of things. We went out in the winter, we went out in the summer, and they taught us how to survive, you know, in that environment. And I thought that that was extremely cool. Now, the other thing that I was shocked about was the number of families that were permanent families that were Black that lived in Alaska. I don't know quite when they came. Maybe it was during the Gold Rush days. I'm not sure. But not all of the Black people that were there were military people. There were families that had been there for generations, and those families are still there. I still keep up with my friends, you know, that in Anchorage that I went to high school with, and those families are still there. And I thought that that was very, very cool, too. It was one of the other few places that had more than me and my sister, you know, as Black people in school. So that was kind of cool. But Alaska, I loved, and I'm hoping that they're able to take care of themselves and to keep things as pure as possible. But I know the oil industry and the profits to be made from that, and the territory that's not, oh, I know that's tempting, but I sure do hope that those folks in Alaska, all money ain't good money. I hope they remember that. And Gosh, I hope they remember that. Alaska is one of the last frontiers, and it would be nice to kind of keep it that way with some modern touches.
We all may have to move up there at some point, so they better make room.
Now, that's the truth. There's plenty of room, but I don't know if you want to live in some of them. In some of those places, once you get up the coastline. And I always wondered how the capital didn't end up in Anchorage, but end up in Juneau, which is way, way, way up there. And there was one time that the only way you could get to Juneau was by flying or, you know, ship or, you know, whatever the road. But now they're roads and that type of stuff. But Juneau was so far away. And most people, when they came into Alaska, came into Anchorage. And then from Anchorage, they went to Fairbanks, you know, and other places. But a lot of my friends' parents had planes like we have the second car, you know. And the kids were in the Civil Air Patrol. A lot of my friends knew how to fly planes. And they hadn't even graduated from high school. But again, it was a part of surviving in that type of environment.
Well, remind our listeners, you're listening to Cheryl Jefferson here in Austin, Texas. It's a remote audio podcast of the Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler. And having a great time, Cheryl. Thanks for having this chat. And now your entire family, all your sisters, how many sisters do you have? Because you're all in Texas, aren't you?
Yes. I have four sisters, and we're all in Texas now. All of us came back to Texas to go to school, and my parents retired in Texas because they're from, like I said, Washington County in Brenham, Texas. So we knew that everyone would... Well, we didn't think we would all end up in Texas. That's the last thing we thought. But we all knew we were going to go to college in Texas. But the twins, they worked in Fairbanks and Anchorage, and then they ended up coming back to Texas. Janelle, the one that's the artist, she was out in California for a while, and now they've moved back to Texas. So yes, all five of us girls are here in Texas. Our kids... one's at the University of Alabama, one is at a record company in New York City, and the other two are in Austin. So we try and get them to leave. You can always come back home. You need to get out, have some experiences, see the world, see some other cultures, learn. And then if you want to end up back here, that's cool. But you need to get out and you need to go and see this world. It's big. It's wonderful. It's getting smaller. And they have friends in just all kinds of different places. And so we encourage them to get out there and see that world. And you can always come back home. You can't live in my house, but you can come back home.
So you encourage diversity.
Oh, my goodness gracious, yes. If it wasn't for diversity, I'd be a crazy person. I guess because from the moment my father took us from Brenham, after he did a lot of overseas stuff, I saw my father for the first time and lived with him when I was four. Up until then, he was the man that would I knew was my dad because his picture was there. And everybody says, oh, your dad is in Korea. Oh, your dad is in Japan. Or your dad is, you know. So we knew that the man existed and stuff. But when he came back when I was four, we moved to California. And that's when we started traveling with my dad. Well, from that first move, California back then was integrated. And so, you know, the schools had some of everybody in it. And the neighborhood that we lived in was kind of an Air Force neighborhood. So you had all kind of folks there. You had people that had married German women or Japanese people. There were Buddhists, there were Jewish people, there were Black people, white people. I mean, it was just our neighborhood was just a hodgepodge of everybody, and you played at everybody's house, you know? And I thought that's how everybody grew up. It came as quite a shock as I got older when I understand that people lived in segregated neighborhoods and they weren't raised like I was raised. But diversity is just, it's not a word. It's the way that you live. You have to live diversity. You can use that word. You can say that you're diverse. But if when people come to your house for happy hour and dinner and you look at that table and you don't have a hodgepodge of people with different mindsets and thoughts and economic backgrounds and cultural backgrounds, you're not really diverse, you know? And yeah, there are times when I want to go to an all-Black event, you know, where I can truly, you know, let loose, you know, and be my, what my Black friends call my Blackish self, you know. Yes, I like to do that. But I also like different people and get into different conversations about different things. I like it, you know, very much. And we have introduced that thought to our kids. And so our kids think that that's the way everybody lives, you know, too. And their friends are just as diverse as ours are. My daughter thinks that we're so slightly odd that when she had to write a paper last year for school and they wanted them to write about an experience in their family settings, she wrote about the happy hours that we have at our house where all of these different people are there and there's all these different conversations going on. And her teacher wrote on her paper, please have your parents invite me to their house. You know? But it's fun. It's wonderful. Life is supposed to be diverse. You're supposed to have all those kinds of experiences. And it is my wish for people out there is to have peace in their life, to have the experience of folks from different backgrounds, different ways of thought, even if you don't agree with the way that they're thinking, you need to hear them anyway, and they need to be part of the conversation. You know, that's important. And this world is becoming like that. When I was giving lectures in school and I looked out at the audience of school and I would see these children of mixed origins, and it became to the point where they would be a good number of the audience. And I thought that that was so cool because it meant that we were mixing and that we were loving people as people and not as, I love you because you're a Black man, you know, or I love you because you're a white woman or whatever, that you fell in love with a person and you married that person and you had children, and those people are persons. I'm tired of all of that stuff. It just, oh, these days I just get so tired of hearing all of it when it isn't necessary, when all of my life I've been in those kind of environments and everyone has gotten along. And even when you disagreed, you talked, you came to a solution and to something that was equitable to both parties. And I don't see why we can't do that in these United States. It just doesn't make a damn bit of sense to me. None at all.
Well, there's your public relations background right there.
Yes, I know. But as I told those children that are out there now, when I talk to younger people, I tell them, look, I boycotted grapes. I did protesting. I did all of this. And now that I am 68 years old, I want to be Cheryl. That's what I want to be. Y'all need to take this over. You guys need to change the world. I did my shot at it. Now what I want to do is write about those experiences, and I want to be Cheryl. I don't want to be a Black woman Cheryl, a short woman Cheryl, a little chubby woman Cheryl. a little balding head because of chemo, Cheryl. I just want to be Cheryl. That is all I want, you know. And I think I have done my part. I have paid my dues. I have contributed to society, and I have raised a wonderful child that is going to go out there and continue that, as our other children that we have raised are going to go out there and continue that. Every intern I had, I try to instill those kinds of things in them to where they go out and they take over and they change the world. I've done it. Now, let me party and have some fun.
Well, listeners, you've been listening to Cheryl Jefferson from Austin, Texas, from the world. Cheryl, this has been a wonderful conversation with you. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. And you know, the most horrible thing to do is put a microphone in front of me and let me talk. You ask me a question and I'll go on forever. You know, but thank you.
This is part one of 10. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening for this is the Art of the Hudson Valley on WGXC 90.7. I'm your host, Chad Weckler. This has been the Art of the Hudson Valley, and thank you for listening.